Hi, my name is Lowell, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser Campus Radio.
Would you give me a beat?
CJSF 90.1 FM is the campus radio station for Simon Fraser University, located on Burnaby Mountain in BC, Canada. CJSF 90.1 FM, diverse, independent, yours. Check us out on SoundCloud or at cjsf.ca.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, commemorating the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, a nuclear scientist remembers,
"What we put into the world was a terrible weapon. But under the circumstances, and with the possibility that the Nazis could get that weapon first, we all felt we had to do it."
The historian paints a different picture.
"There were a lot of scientists at the Manhattan Project who said, wait a minute, shouldn't we do a demonstration shot to show the Japanese? And of course, Oppenheimer said, no, 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 what if it's a dud? You know, we'll be humiliated. No, we've got to see if it works. We've got to test it on the civilian population."
And the Pacific Island nation that paid the other ultimate price, turning America into a nuclear-armed superpower.
"Of course, the first bomb was in Alamogordo, New Mexico, and the second two were in Japan, and they needed someplace for the fourth and fifth test. They wanted someplace that was really far away from everything. And they looked around, and there in the Marshall Islands, way off in the corner, was Bikini Atoll. It was perfect."
Before diving in, a request: help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. "78 years ago, on August 6, 1945, the U.S. dropped a uranium-enriched fission bomb, Little Boy, on the Japanese port city Hiroshima. 3 days later, they dropped a plutonium implosion device, Fat Man, on Nagasaki. When the dust settled, between 130 and 225,000 people were dead or dying, almost all civilians. Thousands more would sicken and die in the years to come. America's public rationale: avoiding the huge casualties resulting from an invasion of the Japanese mainland. The real reasons would emerge in time. Here's a story about the bombings of Japan. It takes its name from a prose poem by American theologian and writer Thomas Merton, The Original Child Bomb. In order of appearance, Maureen O'Dwyer reading Merton's poem, Hans Bethe, the German-American physicist who helped develop the atomic bomb, Martin Johns, former physics scholar at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, and Rosalie Bertel, American-Canadian authority on the effects of ionizing radiation.
"In the year 1945, an original child was born. The name Original Child was given to it by the Japanese people, who recognized that it was the first of its kind.
The discovery by Hahn and Strassmann in Germany of fission was made near the end of 38, and then very soon people began to think of possible applications. There was especially Dr. Szilard in New York, and there were several other theoretical people like Eugene Wigner and Edward Teller. And on the experimental side, by far the most important person was Enrico Fermi. I think from the very beginning they had in mind that this could lead to atomic weapons."
"The fission process was discovered in January of 1939. The clue to it, a problem that had been vexing scientists for about 5 years, was brought by a Jewish refugee woman, a physicist from Berlin. And her German friends in Berlin said, we got to get you out or you're going to end up in a concentration camp. For the next 6 months, every issue of PhysRev had letters to the editor about this exciting new process, because this is the first time that you had put a particle into a nucleus and got the same particles out again. And suddenly people got the clue that if you did that, you could make a chain reaction go. And as soon as that idea got current, which was current by the end of that summer before the war started, people began to realize that there was a possibility of a very powerful weapon out of this.
Nazi Germany was returned to the Dark Ages. The Nazis were killing the people in the occupied countries by the thousands. They were killing Jews in Germany as well as in the occupied countries. They were saying quite openly that they wanted to export this mentality to the rest of the world. That had to be stopped. Heisenberg, one of the great physicists of the age, was working on uranium, and we assumed he was working on an atomic bomb. It was absolutely essential for us to get it first.
February 25th, 1943. Dr. J. R. Oppenheimer, University of California, Berkeley. Dear Dr. Oppenheimer, we are addressing this letter to you as the scientific director of the Special Laboratory in New Mexico in order to confirm our many conversations on the matters of organization and responsibility. You are at the liberty to show this letter to those with whom you are discussing the desirability of their joining the project with you. They, of course, realizing their responsibility as to secrecy, including the details of the organization and personnel. The laboratory will be concerned with the development and final manufacture of an instrument of war, projectile S1T. To this end, the laboratory will be concerned with A.
Oppenheimer studies in science. Was a very complicated person. He felt very strongly that he and we physicists had to contribute something to the war effort. I remember very well an evening party. It was just after the fall of France. And at that moment, he gave a very eloquent talk, 15 minutes, 20 minutes long, in which he said that Western civilization might come to an end if the Nazis were to win the war. What we put into the world was a terrible weapon. But under the circumstances, and with the possibility that the Nazis could get that weapon first, we all felt we had to do it. At the beginning of the project, General Groves, who was in overall charge of the Manhattan Project, went to Chicago and asked people, how big is an atomic bomb going to be? And the scientists there told him, well, we think it will be about 20 kilograms, but it may be 200, or it may be 2. And so General Groves said, that's impossible. How can you give me such an answer? How am I to produce material for you if you don't know how much? It's like you are going to a caterer and saying, I want to give a banquet for 20 people, but it may be 200, or it may be only 2. So we had to calculate as best we could the size of the atomic bomb. And in fact, with the experimental information we then knew, we did pretty well, and it was about 20 kilograms. Canada supplied a lot of uranium for the project, from the El Dorado mine way up north.
There were two main sources of uranium. One was what was then called the Belgian Congo, is now called Zaire, and the other was Uranium City and the Canadian uranium. I know there were several places that were refining uranium. One was in Niagara Falls, New York, at the area that we now know as the Love Canal. That was where some of the Canadian uranium was refined. It was brought across at Niagara Falls and then shipped on to Chicago, where a lot of the research was being done.
We had to predict how much energy this atomic bomb would release. We had a group which was working at the nature of the fireball. How big would it be? How fast would it grow in size? And that turned out to be about the best method to actually measure the yield, the energy from the atomic bomb. We tried to estimate how the fireball would rise, what would happen to the radioactivity after the explosion. And that was important already for the test, because we did not want any radioactivity to come down on any village in the neighborhood of the test. There was a meeting between me and George Placzek, who was the theorist at Montreal, in which I was instructed that I must not tell him anything, but that I should listen to what he had to tell about neutron diffusion. Early in 45, Placzek and two of his collaborators, who were born Canadians, Carson Mark and Bengt Carlson, were invited to come to Los Alamos to work with us and help us in their special area. The Canadian project had done better work about the diffusion of neutrons in a mass of uranium or anything else than we had in the United States. I was at the first test. I was a spectator. There was a large number of us who were stationed about 20 miles from the test, and we could see it, observe it, see the colors and how threatening it looked. It worked, including one particular part of it, which I had a great part in designing, namely the initiator. In the middle of the bomb, there was a little gadget which was to provide neutrons just at the right time. And there was a committee of three to design it, and two of us, including me, outvoted Fermi.
On July 21st, 60 atomic scientists who knew of the Alamogordo test signed a petition that the bomb should not be used against Japan without a convincing warning and an opportunity to surrender. On August 4th, the bombing crew on Tinian watched a movie of Trinity, the Alamogordo test. August 5th was a Sunday, but there was little time for formal worship. They said a quick prayer that the war might end very soon. On that day, Colonel Tibbetts, who was in command of the B-29 that was to drop the bomb, felt that his bomber ought to have a name. He baptized it Enola Gay, after his mother in Iowa. Colonel Tibbetts was a well-balanced man and not sentimental. He did not have a nervous breakdown after the bombing, like some of the other members of the crew.
Civilization!
Exploded within 100 feet of the aiming point. The fireball was 18,000 feet across. The temperature at the center of the fireball was 100 million degrees. The people who were near the center became nothing. The whole city was blown to bits, and the ruins all caught fire instantly, everywhere, burning briskly. 70,000 people were killed right away, or died within a few hours. Those who did not die at once suffered great pain. Few of them were soldiers.
Now, after the war, I was convinced that now the war was over and we should go back to peaceful pursuits. But Edward Teller, he was of the opinion that the real important thing was to continue Los Alamos toward a hydrogen bomb because of the Russians. Weisskopf described to me how one hydrogen bomb might destroy a very big city all at once. That it was really a terrible idea to further increase the power of the atomic bomb. As a consequence of that, I refused to participate in the hydrogen bomb project in the early 1950. In the spring of 51, Edward Teller and Stan Ulam found a way of constructing a hydrogen bomb, and that was immediately so persuasive that all of us who had opposed the hydrogen bomb were persuaded that it would work. That was a complete change, and this complete change also changed my attitude somewhat. Namely, once that idea was out, we had to assume that a similar idea might come to a Soviet physicist, and that therefore we had to be concerned lest the Soviets would get that bomb before us. And so after that, it seemed futile to oppose it. I do feel very strongly that the after effect is very bad, that we have brought this weapon into the world. I think nearly all of us at Los Alamos felt that this must never happen again. And this was the beginning of the scientists' movement against the arms race, against nuclear weapons.
Since that summer, many other bombs have been found. What is going to happen? At the time of writing, after a season of brisk speculation, men seem to be fatigued by the whole question.
The original child bomb was adapted from a radio documentary produced by Clive Ball, Ed Reese, and myself back in 1986. It takes its name from a prose poem by the American Trappist monk and writer Thomas Merton. We interviewed Hans Bethe in his office at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. Read more about Hans Bethe, Martin Johns, and Rosalie Bertel at greenplanetmonitor.net. Thanks to Brenda Muller for her cello and Michael J. Berthelmer for his melancholic guitar, and to the Firesign Theater, America's counterculture comics. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor. If you're appreciating this podcast, go to greenplanetmonitor.net and subscribe or donate or both. With your generous help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Almost 80 years after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the real reasons for America's hideous assault have been unearthed by a small army of scholars. Among these, a guy named Glenn Alcoway. Back in the mid-1970s, Alcoway spent 2 years as a Peace Corps volunteer in the Marshall Islands, just north of the equator in the Central Pacific. The U.S. carried out 67 nuclear tests there between 1946 and 1958. Among these, the first ever hydrogen bomb, Bravo, at Bikini Atoll. Alcoway spent those 2 years on a small atoll downwind from Bikini. Inspired by that experience, he began researching the impacts of U.S. weapons testing on the Marshallese people and the true history of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the stuff you won't learn about from the blockbuster film Oppenheimer. You saw Oppenheimer.
Yes.
Or as people are calling it, Barbenheimer. Because everybody that's being shown is a double feature with Barbie.
And I can't think of two more opposite films, really.
You wrote an article for an opinion piece for Counterpunch about after having seen Oppenheimer. What did you think of Oppenheimer? Did it tell the true story about why the bomb was used? Why the bombs were used?
I think it did. Unfortunately, that will become our unofficial history. Those watching Oppenheimer, especially the Gen Z generation, you know, people who were not alive during that time, unfortunately, this will become the history of the Manhattan Project, as well as Christopher Nolan did with his project, his three-hour project. He did make some serious omissions. For example, the overtures to peace, he lightly touched on that very superficially, but he really overshadowed that with the idea that this was a historical inevitability. Oppenheimer and Leslie Groves, the guy who built the Pentagon, the chief architect, they were determined to see how the so-called gadget, that's how they called it, the gadget, they wanted to see if it worked. There were a lot of scientists at the Manhattan Project who said, wait a minute, shouldn't we do a demonstration shot? To show the Japanese. And of course, Oppenheimer said, no, what if it's a dud? You know, we'll be humiliated. No, we've got to see if it works. We've got to test it on the civilian population. So Oppenheimer actually planned targets with Leslie Groves, and these were not military targets. Hiroshima and Nagasaki had very little military activity. It was always about civilians. And by the way, the myth that it was the atomic bombings, Nagasaki, that ended the war. Not so fast. There's a little more to the story. Apparently, it was the Russian invasion through Manchuria that caused the Japanese to finally surrender. In fact, it took them 5 days after Nagasaki, from August 9th to August 14th. It took them 5 days to actually surrender because it was the Russian invasion, the impending Russian invasion, as well as the atomic bombings, of course, that caused the Japanese to surrender. But the reason it took so long is we had been bombing their cities. Anybody who knows anything about World War II, the Doolittle air raids over Tokyo, we learned that the building structures in Japan were all made of wood, so they decided to use incendiary bombs, fire bombs. So Tokyo was on fire. Many of the Japanese cities were on fire, and therefore when we hit Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Japanese officials said, well, we have so many of our cities under attack, these are just two more cities. It really was not the atomic bombings. It aided in their decision to surrender, but it was really the impending Russian invasion that scared the crap out of them. And that's what made them finally decide to surrender.
Okay, now let's back up for a second, Glenn Alcoway. The old story, which I understand to be a myth, and it's been known to be kind of largely mythological for years, is that the leaders, right, Truman and his closest advisors and military people said, look, we've got to use the bomb because the Japanese are totally recalcitrant. They're not going to surrender, and we're going to have to invade the mainland of Japan, and it's going to cost huge numbers of lives, American lives and Japanese lives. They were principally concerned with the American lives. So we've got to use the bomb.
The rationale was it was going to, quote, save American lives. How many American lives if we had to invade Japan, the homeland? 1 million. So the number was thrown out there to the American people that it was going to save 1 million lives. Who could be against that, right? Later on, they revised the number downwardly to, they said, well, it wasn't really 1 million lives that would have been saved. It was 500,000 lives. And then from there, it kept going down. A very important book by Greg Mitchell several years ago, he estimated that it was really just about 50,000 American lives that would have been saved, not 1 million American lives. Yet that rationale was able to convince 80% of the public to go ahead and use the bombs. Truman actually was asked after the war about his decision to drop the bomb. And what he said was, if the American people learned that we had the secret weapon to use against the Japanese and we did not use it, he said the American people would not stand for that. So that was Truman's kind of alibi. But there's so much more to the story about Truman deciding to use the bomb. Because Eisenhower was against it. Eisenhower, you know, who led the D-Day invasion, by the way, he was our war hero, went on to become president in 1952. Eisenhower warned Truman, he said, don't use that awful thing. He said, we don't want to be the first country to have used that thing. He was right on the money.
When did he say that?
Before Truman actually decided to use the bomb, Eisenhower talked to the then Secretary of Defense, Henry Stimson, and he told Stimson, look, the Japanese are already defeated. We don't really need to use that thing. So he said that in real time at the right moment before Truman actually, you know, dropped the bombs in Japan.
Okay, so Eisenhower told Truman, don't drop the bombs. What other military leaders, I gather 6 out of 7 of the 5-star generals at the time, said, don't use the bomb? Who were the other ones?
Well, Admiral Leahy was the commander of the entire Pacific Theater. Admiral Leahy, he knew exactly what was going on in Japan. He warned Truman before Truman dropped the bomb. He said, look, the Japanese are actually signaling peace initiatives through back channels with the Soviet Union. He said the Japanese are already defeated. So he warned Truman not to use the bomb. Thirdly, Bull Halsey, one of our famous admirals, he was actually in charge of sending the troops to Japan, the Okinawa invasion. He was in charge of that. So Bull Halsey even told Truman, look, the Japanese are ready to surrender. We've defeated them. You do not need to use that bomb. So 3 of our top commanders were telling Truman, don't use the bomb. He used it anyway. He and Oppenheimer, but Oppenheimer really pushed to use it. He wanted to see if it was going to work.
And who is Joseph Rotblat?
Joseph Rotblat, he was a British-American physicist at the Manhattan Project. In 1943, he decided that the big fear in at the beginning of the Manhattan Project was that Germany would also build an atomic bomb. So there was a real race who could develop the bomb more quickly. In 1943, Joseph Rotblat at the Manhattan Project decided that they were not going to be able to catch up to the U.S., and therefore he quit the project. He said, look, my idea of building the bomb was to stop the Germans. The Germans are not building a bomb. And he also feared that if we built the bomb, it could eventually be used against the USSR. So he walked off the project. 2 years later, the Celio Szilard had a petition where 70 of the Manhattan Project scientists signed on to the Szilard petition that said, look, let's demonstrate the bomb to the Japanese before we actually use it on them. And of course, Oppenheimer quashed it. He said, no, none of that. We're going to use the damn bomb. Get out of the way. So Rotblat became a hero. 10 years after I met him in 1985, in 1995, Joseph Rotblat went on to win the Nobel Peace Prize with Pugwash, his organization called Pugwash, an anti-nuclear organization. Then he died 10 years later in 2005.
So can you review this history again for me? At the end of July 1945, there's the Potsdam Conference. Truman and Stalin agreed that the Russians would proceed to invade first Manchuria and then Japan.
Yeah.
And the Russians were already receiving peace overtures from the Japanese.
That's right.
And the Americans knew this because they had cracked the code.
Yeah. So here's what happened. FDR died in April. Truman became president. We were working with the Russians at the time. We were on the same side. But at Potsdam, it was the big three. It was Winston Churchill, Stalin from Russia, and then Truman. So at Potsdam in July, this is 3 weeks before Hiroshima, Potsdam, that they would invade Japan, they would help us end the war would end. But what happened was, and the idea was, it was agreed at Potsdam that Russia would invade Japan on August 8th and August 9th. Truman